so first of all, thank you so much to Erica Fudge for organizing this meeting. I've learned so much from all of you. It's been really, really illuminating. So first and foremost, has anyone here encountered this novel before, Saltfish Girl? No, I'll just read the back cover just so you can kind of get a sense of what it's about. Set alternately in 19th century China and in a futuristic Canadian Pacific Northwest, Saltfish Girl is the mesmerizing tale of an ageless female character who shifts shape and form through time and place. This is a remarkable novel about gender, love, honor, intrigue, and fighting against the dark forces of biotechnology. So the addition that I made to my title is just to add in addition to queering origin stories, also biotechnological features in the novel. So in both content and form, Larissa Lai's novel, Saltfish Girl, is curiously bifurcated. Cutting across the binaries of the human, of gender, and of nature, the first chapter, entitled The Bifurcation, floods the pages with tropes of Eastern and Western creation myths. The first-person omniscient voice tells us in the opening section that, in the beginning, there was just me. Set at the bank of the Yellow River, at the time when the land was not the land, the sea not the sea, the air not the air, the sky not the sky, this primordial past detailing the creative impulses of a solitary figure is soon unfurled into a narrative of relentlessly replicating and reincarnating bodies. In Lai's speculative fiction, the opening chapter's bifurcating narrative ties together Nuwah, a mother creator figure, with Miranda Chang, a daughter who is miraculously conceived when her postmenopausal mother comes into contact with a durian fruit. The narrative is set in a prelapsarian past that weaves into an eerie anthropocenic future of mutant genes and biotechnologically produced clones in the Canadian Pacific Northwest, queering the origin stories of Miranda and Nuwah and Miranda's lover, who is a human carp clone, until none of the stories are discernible from one another. These shifting voices and bodies ultimately queer origin stories altogether, illustrating how the post-immigrant diaspora consciousness of Canadian Asian subjects is conveyed into Lai's eco-feminist and queer literary project, which subverts the binary systems of language that would separate the human from the non-human, male from female, nature from culture. So a number of literary scholars of Lai's novel have astutely examined the national, mythological, and evolutionary tropes of Saltfish Girl, arguing that Lai's attention to queering origin stories has in turn enabled her to deconstruct identity categories in a mode of post-humanist critique. So my own approach to Lai's novel builds on these observations, but contextualizes the queer and eco-feminist aspects of the novel amidst the biotechnological futures of the Anthropocene. So drawing from recent work on Anthropocene feminisms, particularly in an edited collection by Richard Bruson containing essays by Claire Colebrook, Rosie Ridotti, and other key scholars of post-humanist and materialist feminist criticism, this paper makes a case for speculative sex that queers the myth of human origins along with the essentialized Earth Mother trope that is rendered by the novel's late capitalist regime, which in turn engenders alternative visions of anthropocenic time and feminist futures. Through scenes of queer sex, Lai's novel subverts heteronormative and procreative sexual practices in order to reconsider the entanglement of human evolutionary history with a coalition or kinship politics that crosses species barriers and strains against the dualisms that have been entrenched in the masculinist logic of the Anthropocene. So I want to show that Lai's novel produces a queer and eco-feminist paradigm that illustrates the multilabial, fluid, cross-pollinatory, mutant, variant, differential, unstable, intersectional, interspecies, procreative, and reproductive possibilities that politically counter anthropocenic forces. More specifically, I propose that scenes of sex in the novel emblematize the fluidity and slipperiness of queer women's writing and convey the embodied history and futurity of planetary life in an increasingly perilous and precarious epoch of climate change, genetic mutation, and ecological collapse. So in order to demonstrate how Lai's queer sexual subjectivities utilize tools of the speculative fiction genre to establish co-productive political ties with queer kin, so non-human others, etc., in the Anthropocene, I began with a couple of key points. So the first, of course, is to supply evidence that discourses of the Anthropocene have been largely masculinist. The second is to briefly chart an eco-feminist genealogy of thought that works against this masculinist logic. And then the third and more substantive task is to close read particular scenes of speculative sex in the novel, from lesbian sex and immaculate human vegetable or vegetal conceptions to fishy labors and births in water, and to make a case for the creative possibilities of this writing, to inaugurate a queer and ecofeminist political paradigm for the Anthropocene. So I won't rehearse the arguments of the contributors to Anthropocene feminism at any length, given our time restraints, but what we can glean from this landmark volume is that critiques of the Anthropocene stem from its androcentrism, heteronormativity, and its rigid cartographical conceptions of time and space. So Elizabeth Pavanelli, the author of Geontologies, she warns us of the Enlightenment era's consideration of man's domination over the Earth, which writes climate change into the Earth's own stratigraphical records. While Stacy Limo questions the anthro of the Anthropocene as a set of largely white, heterosexual, disembodied, and rational voices. So the initial constitution of the scientific board responsible for coining the term Anthropocene was largely male, and also there's several centuries of history in the West from the Industrial Revolution to the present that convey a record of androcentric conquests that treated nature as the source for innumerable extractable resources. So to be sure, the trope of a ravaged Mother Earth struck with the birth pangs of the Anthropocene, which is echoed in an otherwise excellent book by Jeremy Davies. Ecofeminist scholars from the 1990s onwards have illuminated how the chiefly geological configuration of the Anthropocene often rigidly maintains the dualistic binaries that ecofeminists have sought to trouble in the manner of Donna Haraway's Staying with the Trouble, for example. So taking on ecofeminist theory for the Anthropocene, scholars like Astrida Nemanis followed the history of Écriture Féminine. So for those who aren't literature scholars, it's sort of literally writing, women's writing from the body, which is championed by Luce Irigaray and Helen Csikszentmihalyi. So Nemanis, alongside the history of Écriture Féminine, also puts together recent developments in theory by Elizabeth Gross and Stacy Limo to build a queer and ecofeminist reconsideration of the Anthropocene through her book Bodies of Water, Post-Human Feminist Phenomenology. So in it, she claims that to figure ourselves as bodies of water not only rejects a human separation from nature out there, it also torques many of our accepted cartographies of space, time, and species, and implicates a specifically watery movement of difference and repetition. And she means this in a very Deleuzian sense. So proposing concepts like post-human gestationality, which I'll return to again at the conclusion of the paper, Nemanis argues that water constitutes one of the so-called Anthropocene's most urgent, visceral, and ethically fraught sites of political praxis and theoretical inquiry. So in plainer language, what ecofeminist scholars imagine is a kind of wet politics, one that is affirmative in the face of the rigid rhetoric of the Anthropocene, and which operates according to a slippery set of practices. So I propose that Lai's novel models the slipperiness of reactionary politics for the Anthropocene through what I've been calling speculative sex, which I define as the queer practice that reimagines the limits of what is possible for the biotechnological future through the merging of interspecies bodies. And these scenes of speculative sex arise from non-human conceptions, cyborg sex, and oceanic rebirths. So to give these scenes some context, it's important to understand that the novel's biotechnological regime is configured in masculine terms. So at the helm of this cloning project is Dr. Rudy Flowers, who is responsible for creating these human carb clones, as well as for managing a kind of eugenic-style program of testing for cases like Miranda Chang, who is plagued with this potent and unmistakable odor of durian fruit. Has anyone here had durian fruit before? Yeah, so you know what this is about. And so other fishy and briny smells that come to be understood as the result of this vestigial organ she has, this fistula that she calls it, which, and this is from the novel, recalls a time when we were more closely related to fish, a time when the body glistened with scales and turned in the dark, muscled easily through water. In a timeline that extends from the years 2044 to 2062, we read that Flowers' laboratory is housed in an abandoned hotel in the unregulated zone, which was damaged by a flood in 2017. The lab is surrounded by ocean water with a wall of sturdy plexiglass that keeps the ocean, and this is a quote, pressed full and furious at being shut out of this territory, which clearly belonged by natural rights to it and not to us. It slammed things against it, seaweed, old bottles, frayed rope, scrap metal, swaying schools of fish, whatever it could conjure up from its polluted floor. So along with this attempt to control nature and ferry it into contained spaces and discrete ontological categories, Dr. Flowers has been bioengineering an all-female labor force out of racial minorities, indigenous peoples, and those facing extinction in what he calls a diverse genome project. So Evie, excuse me, who becomes Miranda's lover, is 0.03% freshwater carp, the product of an experiment generating at least 100,000 identical clones. But amidst all of this manipulation of biomaterial on the part of Flowers, there are unforeseen moments of resistance that are wielded by non-human conceptions, cyborg sex and oceanic rebirths. So political resistance in the novel is forged in the unstable alliances between the non-human and human figures. So for instance, non-human conceptions like the durian fruit are the result of an original experiment gone haywire, originally meant as a fertility therapy for women who could not conceive. The implantation of human genes into a durian tree 3 generations earlier now spawns the immaculate conception of a baby in Miranda's womb. It's all conjecture, but Sonia 14 says it started a century ago. They were implanting human genes into a fruit as fertility therapy for women who could not conceive. What we learned was that the fruit of certain trees could make women pregnant without any need for insemination. Some of these interspecies conceptions have led to unexpected results, even for Evie, who has escaped the project and joined a group of other clones, some of which are sourced from fish, some from cats, and some from other species, planning to sabotage the industries that exploit them. "We're not designed for wits or willpower," Evie tells Miranda, "but I was an early model. They couldn't control for everything. Maybe the fish was the unstable factor." So despite Dr. Flowers' manipulation of human and non-human genomes, the slippage between species barriers and bodies becomes the basis for querying the origin stories and futures of Miranda and Evie. So at the level of language, scenes of sex are embodied, figuratively constructed to reflect the body breathing underwater, muscling through a stream, melding together flesh. The first sexual encounter with Evie and Miranda reflects this kind of embodied consciousness. "The fishiness of her drew me, but I tried not to think about the strangeness of her conception. Her fingers moved over my skin, cool and tingly as ice water. I wanted to turn into water myself, fall into her the way rain falls into the ocean. I moved through the cool dark with her, my body a single silver muscle, slipping against hers, flailing for oxygen in a fast underwater current, shivering slippery cool wet and tumbling through dark towards a blue point of light in the distance, teeth, lip, nipple, the steel taste of blood, gills gaping open and closed, mouth, breath, cool water running suddenly piss hot against velvet inner thighs, and the quick shudder, silver flash of fish turning above the ice blue surface of the lake." Desire in the scene is an impulse that inspires queer temporalities and an evolutionary past and biotechnological future, plunging Evie and Miranda into a wet and unwieldy space of procreative possibilities through a play on the fish's own indeterminate gender and its sexual and reproductive practices. So juxtaposed with the linear and prescriptive logic of Dr. Flowers' calling regime, this stream of consciousness account of trans species copulation utilizes the unstable figure of the cyborg to challenge the dark forces of technology, of biotechnology. Speculative sex in Lai's novel illustrates Donna Haraway's insistence that cyborg politics is the struggle for language and the struggle against perfect communication, against the one code that translates all meaning perfectly, the central dogma of phallocentrism. So the queer kinship forged between Evie and Miranda through the act of fishy human sex creates multiplicities and variations of resistance to the program of anthropocenic change. The final scene in the novel, which terminates in the birth of a new black-haired baby girl amidst the scales and coiling tails of Miranda and Evie, similarly reflects the fluid and multiplicitous variations between bodies and beings. In this final chapter, Miranda and Evie confront Dr. Flowers, who has killed off all the Sonias, which are the human cat clones responsible for cultivating the durian trees in the unregulated zone, which has produced all of these natural mutations and pseudo-immaculate conceptions. So now realizing that she is pregnant from the durian fruit, Miranda thinks, "We are the new children of the earth's revenge. Once we stepped out of mud, now we step out of moist earth, out of DNA both new and old, an imprint of what has gone before, but also a variation. By our difference, we mark how ancient the alphabet of our bodies. By our strangeness, we write our bodies into the future. Having apprehended her own origins and the origins of the baby growing in her womb, Miranda sees her body as an alphabet figure, a genetic code creatively recomposing itself out of its primordial aqueous substance and into an unfurling future. As the fetus comes to term, Miranda and Evie visit the back end of Dr. Flowers' laboratory at the Zodiac Aquarium, which is the site of Evie's birth. They gaze upon brightly colored fish in the tanks, an octopus with undulating tentacles, a lungfish the length of a human body. The parallels between Evie's own body and the shimmering lungfish are presented alongside the sterile tables of the laboratory, upon which sit vials of fertilized and unfertilized eggs. The fecundity of the scene strikes Miranda as unsettling. All these tidy attempts to control the mud and muck of origins upset me, she says. Following this visit to the Zodiac Aquarium, Evie and Miranda flee and find a hot spring in the mountains, where Miranda delivers her immaculately conceived baby. Yes, I thought, an ancient ocean bubbling up through the rocks, salty and full of minerals. I scrambled desperately towards it, shed my clothes, and slipped in. No shame as the coils unraveled. And to my surprise, Evie too slipped out of her clothes and slid into the water. Her legs fused together, and as her skin met water, a thin layer of tiny silver scales began to form and glisten in the moonlight. She stretched her tail through mine, and our coils interlocked and slid through one another, and then all of a sudden, I found myself breathing these great, heavy, heaving breaths. My belly heaved and contracted. Blood streamed into the water, staining it. I howled with the pain of womb spasming deeply, and then a dark head emerged 6 inches below my navel from an opening in my scaly new flesh. The head had a wrinkled human face. Evie reached underwater, guided the thing out, black-haired and bawling, a little baby girl. Everything will be all right, I thought, until next time. Mixing pleasure with pain, human with non-human, this birthing scene conjures up the rhetoric of Anthropocene feminists, who would argue for a queer and feminist writing that would resist the binary system of writing and the phallic symbolic patterns of Anthropocene discourse. So unlike the vials and tubes of manipulated biomaterial in Dr. Flowers' laboratory, which convey a sense of a singular and authoritative administration of evolutionary development, the creation of a child in the novel's concluding pages eliminate the multiplicit and multilabial meanings of life that rail against a prescribed biotechnological future. Such a watery vision of an anthropocenic future reveals Lai's queer and ecofeminist politics of resistance. The fluid, interspecies, and intersectional scenes of sex in Lai's speculative fiction unseat the human from its privileged position in the discourse of the Anthropocene, resembling instead what Astrida Neumannis calls a, quote, more than human hydrocommons. Neumannis' conception of the post-human gestationality captures the shared aqueousness, which anchors an evolutionary past with an unstable future. Post-human gestationality, she writes, is expanded by exploring evolutionary science and related stories of embodied indebtedness, where past and future bodies swim through our own. The creative repetition and mutant variability of genetic codes that link bodies together is outlined in the ecofeminist science of fiction in Saltfish Girl, illuminating a hydrocommons that the masculinist logic of Anthropocene rhetoric would tend to obfuscate or evade. However, I would argue that this posthumanist gesture to the queerness of the female body in particular marks Lai's novel as a watershed work of speculative fiction that presents an affirmative politics of resistance in an increasingly perilous future. Through immaculate human vegetal conceptions to fishy labors and births in the water, Lai's novel opposes the geologic and stratigraphical epistemologies of the Anthropocene, instead conveying it fluidly into an unstable and affirmatively procreative future. Thank you.